The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
As the U.S. grapples with systemic racism and policing problems, we look to lessons from around the globe. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission helped South Africa confront the human costs of apartheid. Could something similar happen here?
I'm not sure whether the U.S. is ready for that conversation. I'm not sure how successful that will be in the States.
I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show today, how German police approach their jobs.
They don't like their guns and they are not trigger happy.
And The Big Fix, our weekly focus on climate solutions, takes us to Bangladesh. They've nearly perfected the science of preparing for a big storm.
These kinds of cyclones in the past have taken hundreds of thousands of lives, but they don't do that anymore.
Neighbors helping neighbors is a big reason why. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is one of the sad paradoxes of modern life. There is plenty of food on this planet to feed all of us, but in a typical year, more than 800 million people still go hungry. This year, the economic fallout surrounding the pandemic might push those numbers higher as people struggle to afford food. That's according to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Unless immediate action is taken, it is increasingly clear that there is an impending global food emergency that could have long-term impacts on hundreds of millions of children and adults.
In Central America, the risk of widespread hunger during the pandemic is enormous. That's where we start things on the show today with The World's Jorge Valencia. He spoke with a shop owner in Guatemala City's biggest food market.
The shop owner's name is Rosa Izquierdo. She and her husband have two children and a small shop.
Se llama Depósito Fortaleza.
The name loosely translates to the strength deposit.
Porque es la fortaleza del Señor Jesucristo.
Because it exists thanks to the strength of our Lord Jesus Christ, she says. And they sell all sorts of grains and legumes in bulk.
Granos básicos es frijol, arroz,
beans, rice, corn, sugar, flour for bread or tortillas. And Izquierdo says that since the beginning of the pandemic, business has been booming.
Ajá, entonces como son productos de canasta básica, así que se consumen a diario.
Izquierdo says that what she and her husband sell are staples of the Guatemalan diet, so people need to buy them. As a result, the market where they work has been more crowded than ever. Izquierdo recorded this video this week when she was going into work at La Terminal Market. It's so big that it's basically its own neighborhood. There are dozens of people wearing masks and walking right past each other. There's a guy carrying a stack of crates on his shoulder. Another guy pushes a wheelbarrow full of mangoes.
Tenemos que usar mascarilla y desinfectante para las manos.
Izquierdo says workers are required to wear a mask, use hand sanitizer, and keep a distance from each other. And she says she follows the rules closely because she thinks other workers in the market may have been sick.
Yo digo que sí. Yo digo que sí porque hay personas que se... Yo me enteré de un señor.
I think so, she says, because I've heard rumors about people who have symptoms and suddenly they just stop showing up. And Izquierdo isn't alone in her suspicion. Kevin Martinez Folgar is a physician from Guatemala working on a PhD in epidemiology at Drexel University. He says La Terminal Market may be a focal point for the virus.
Also, it could be really one of the main drivers to the spread of the virus to the rural areas.
So, La Terminal is an example of how supply chains are vital to keeping everyone fed, but commerce has to be done carefully so workers don't get each other sick. Martinez Folgar says that's especially important for people in the cities and in rural areas.
All the pandemic starts in cities because the cities are the connection to the world from each country.
But a bigger issue is perhaps not the distribution of food, but rather making sure everyone has access to healthy food. So says Manuel Ramirez Sea, an epidemiologist at the Institute for Nutrition in Central America and Panama.
In the last 20 years, there has been a decrease in the undernutrition prevalence in Guatemala and other Central American countries.
Ramirez Sea is referring to Guatemala's neighbors, southern Mexico, Honduras, and El Salvador. And he says leading up to the pandemic, the issue in the region was increasing obesity.
So when you go to a home, you can see a very short child under 5 years of age. So they have a chronic undernutrition. But also when you see the mother, she's overweight.
And Ramirez Sea says this could become a bigger issue as the pandemic continues. The Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean says as many as 16 million people across the continent could fall into extreme poverty this year, leading to under- or malnutrition. Guatemala and its neighbors are some of the most vulnerable countries. So far, Ramirez Sea says, the country has been managing with the pandemic.
I think there are many factors that are protecting the country in some way, because so far the health system has been enough for the speed that this epidemic has happened in Guatemala.
And for Rosa Izquierdo, the shop owner, she says she's grateful she has work.
Damos gracias a Dios todos los días la oportunidad que nos da de.
She says she gives thanks to God every day for what she has. She knows there are people getting sick or going hungry every day. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Policing in the U.S. The problems have come into even sharper focus since a Minneapolis police officer killed George Floyd late last month. Democratic lawmakers have proposed sweeping changes to address some of those problems. They include incentivizing anti-bias training and curbing the transfer of military equipment to law enforcement agencies. We wanted to know what's worked in other countries. Today we're looking at Germany. Police recruits there spend up to 4 years in training and can get a degree in policing. In the U.S., training for cops lasts on average of 19 weeks. Joachim Kirsten teaches at the German Police University in Münster. I asked him to explain the thinking behind such a long training period.
Well, you know, you have already raised the point, anti-bias training. Now, that's something we've been doing for the last, I would say, at least 15 to 20 years. The experience is that this only works when you do it as an interactive training. So if you do this in the classroom with a teacher there and saying, don't do this, and because people who have a different color of skin are also human beings and so on, it doesn't work. So these things have to be trained, not only during the course, but repeatedly afterwards in practice, in service trainings, as interactive trainings, meaning they go through situations where they are tested in their behavior with people from different cultural background, different color of skin, a different sexual orientation, and so on. Now, this sounds all very wonderful, but the fact is that in Germany right now, we have a similar debate on racism in the police, also discriminatory behavior, and so on. So it's not that the kind of training really is a 100% waterproof solution of all the problems of nasty policing.
Yeah, well, German police do have their own problems with racial profiling. There was a 2017 report by the UN that concluded that institutional racism was entrenched within police institutions in Germany. So what kind of problems have been identified and what's being done to change them?
Well, the problem with ethnic profiling is that it is not necessarily based on racist stereotypes. It is sort of like if they do controls, let's say federal police in a train, where you have a small number of people who look different, they are more likely to be asked their papers, their identity, and so on. In front of the other mainstream passengers, this is not only felt as discriminatory, it in fact is discriminatory behavior.
And I know so there have been grievances within the Turkish community in Germany. Is that what you're referring to? There was not a gun involved in the killing of George Floyd, but there have been guns used in other police killings of black men and women in this country. There is new proposed legislation that would require deadly force to be used only as a last resort for officers. What do you emphasize around the use of guns by police in Germany?
Actually, in police training, this may sound a little bit idealistic, the strongest weapon of policemen and policewomen is their word, how they speak, how they approach someone. The aim is not to shoot. Full stop.
So how does that come up in training? I mean, if a German police officer has only seconds to assess the danger of a suspect, in training, what are they told they have as different options?
Well, the training is that they are confronted with these situations in a studio with a screen, and then you see how they respond. And if they, these trainings are not once during the 2.5 year course, but they are repeatedly. So they have to go there, I don't know, every month, once or twice. They don't like their guns and they are not trigger happy. Also, I think that we have learned our historical lesson. The U.S. have a historical burden of slavery. We have the historical burden of the Holocaust and the active contribution of police. I think it took us from 45 to the mid-70s until police changed. See, this process was not ordered from above. It was internal reform within the police itself. And that kind of reform, I'm sorry, I have not really been able to observe in relation to slavery. So I don't want to patronize or be paternalistic. But I think that reform process has to come from within the police, and it has to continue over a longer period of time. So any short-term, one-size-fits-all solution is not to be taken seriously.
Joachim Kirsten teaches at the German Police University in Münster. Professor Kirsten, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
The video conferencing company Zoom is under scrutiny today after it blocked a prominent Chinese activist from using its service. That activist is based in the U.S. Critics say Zoom is censoring users here in the U.S. at the request of China. Here's The World's Lydia Emanuelidou.
A couple weeks ago, at the end of May, about 250 people, some in the U.S., some in China, got on a Zoom call. They were attending a virtual vigil meant to commemorate the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Zhou Fengshou was one of the students who, in 1989, led the protest in Tiananmen, calling for democracy, free speech, and a free press in China. The protests were crushed by Chinese authorities. Zhou organized this video conference through the U.S.-based nonprofit he co-founded. It's called Humanitarian China.
What's significant about this conference is this is the first conference in last 31 years to have such a broad representation of every major groups of the Tiananmen legacy.
There were former student leaders, writers, scholars, activists from Hong Kong and Taiwan.
I was full of anxious anticipation even during the meeting.
Zhou is based in the U.S., but he says he was anxious because he knew Chinese authorities were onto this meeting. He says activists in China had been warned by police there not to join. Tiananmen is a sensitive topic on the mainland. The 3.5-hour video conference went smoothly. It wasn't until a few days later, when Zhou tried to log into his Zoom account, that he realized something was wrong.
We discovered the account was closed.
His Zoom account was shut down. He reached out to the company and tried to get an explanation, but didn't hear back. In a statement to The World, Zoom said that, as a global company, it has to, quote, comply with local laws, but didn't specify precisely what laws they were referring to.
They are trying to apply political censorship from Beijing to us. This is not acceptable.
Other activists critical of China say they've had similar issues with the platform recently. Yacho Wang is a China researcher with Human Rights Watch. She says Zoom has been facing questions about the influence the Chinese government has over it for a while now. The company's based here in the U.S., in California, but it has staff and subsidiaries in China. Unlike some U.S.-based platforms like Facebook and Google, Zoom is available in China. Wang says it's not surprising that Zoom would place restrictions on users on the mainland to continue operating there.
I think what's unique this time is that Zoom is silencing, censoring people outside of China.
Wang says Zoom is not the first global company to succumb to Chinese pressure. Apple, for example, has removed many virtual private network applications from its Chinese app store. VPNs allow users to look at websites that are blocked in China. Zhou Fengshou with Humanitarian China eventually got his account back, but he says he hopes the U.S. government and private companies will stand up to China.
We have to change the rule of the game. Otherwise, every U.S. company would go down this path of trying to appease Beijing for the benefit of profit.
He says he wants to see companies refuse to operate in China until they stop censoring those within and outside of the country. And he hopes to see the U.S. government take a stance, too. For the world, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Coming up, we head to Bangladesh for expert advice on handling big storms. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. 3 weeks ago, Cyclone Amphan hit the coasts of India and Bangladesh with the force of a Category 2 hurricane. The damage was intense, but in low-lying Bangladesh, there were relatively few deaths. That's partly because a storm-prone country has gotten good at preparing for cyclones. How they do it is the focus of this week's Climate Solutions segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The world's Anna Kusmer is here to talk about Bangladesh's emergency response and what the rest of the world can learn from it. Anna, how badly was Bangladesh affected by Cyclone Amphan?
So the storm hit the coast pretty hard, and there was a lot of damage, particularly to farmland, to forests, and a lot of homes were lost. The actual numbers of lives lost in the storm was remarkably low, around 16 people. And that marks some really big progress for the country. Amphan was the strongest cyclone in decades in the region. And just 30 years ago, cyclones of a really similar size had death tolls in the hundreds of thousands.
So how was Bangladesh able to do so well?
Because the Bay of Bengal is one of the most active and intense cyclone regions in the world, Bangladesh has been working really hard on improving their systems. That includes both technical stuff like satellite tracking storms and developing warning systems to get the message out to people more effectively and quickly. But a key thing about the strategy is really hyper-local. It's helping neighbors help each other get to shelters and do what they need to do to prepare for the storm right as it's about to hit the coast. I talked to Muhan Kumar Mandal, and he says when Amphan hit his coastal village right near the capital, Dhaka, he helped people by actually letting them into his home, which was really sturdy and was able to weather the storm.
A lot of people from the community came to us in our building to take shelter. So we cannot leave my home because people are already take shelter in my building.
This concept of neighbors kind of working together on a really local level is actually a key theme in Bangladesh's response system.
Yeah, so how does the government there encourage this kind of community-based response?
They've really invested in getting cyclone warning systems integrated within the social fabric of communities. So that's stuff like getting the message to school kids and then encouraging those kids to help their parents and grandparents know that the storm is coming and get to shelters and things like that. And they work really closely with local networks on the ground, like small NGOs and coastal villages. Here's Muhan again.
A lot of social organizations, like the youth organization, like the local club, local cooperatives, local charity, they're trying to distribute some water and distribute some food.
Like you said, Anna, it's neighbors helping neighbors. Pretty inspiring.
And it's really a government-coordinated response. It's part of a strategy.
The world's Anna Kusmer, thank you very much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
I got more details about how locals helping each other can be part of a national storm strategy. That's what I heard from an expert based in Dhaka in Bangladesh, Salimul Haq, director of the International Center for Climate Change and Development in Bangladesh.
We are a socially extremely cohesive society. Everybody wants to help each other. And in times of distress, everyone does move and help each other. So I think that's an extremely important element in the resilience of any given country or any given place.
How do you think policy helped enable that process? And is there a lesson there for the rest of the world?
I think so. Policy is extremely important, particularly in giving priority to being better prepared and being better, more knowledgeable about what to do and putting in the infrastructure that's needed to enable people to cope with the impact. So, you know, we can't prevent the cyclones. In fact, with climate change, they're going to get even more intense. Amphan became a super cyclone because the Bay of Bengal was above normal temperature. enabling people to know what to do, providing the right policies from the government side, building the cyclone shelters in the right locations, providing information over the media and through volunteers. These are all very important elements in putting pieces of the puzzle together that enables the country to become more resilient to at least reducing the loss of human lives. It doesn't reduce everything, but it does reduce the loss of human lives.
And does the Bangladeshi government continue to improve those efforts?
Very much so. We have a very efficient disaster management ministry department, very well connected with the meteorological department who do the satellite tracking. And we have a very good network of non-governmental organizations, NGOs all over the country.
So when we consider the kind of principles of social fabric, social networks in responding to cyclones in Bangladesh, do you see those ideas as principles applied to other systems in Bangladesh, like rebuilding after cyclones?
Yes, we are trying to do that. I would say the cyclone situation is a relatively simple one in the sense that it's a storm that you can track over time. And when it hits, it's a matter of hours that you have to spend in a shelter before the wind speeds drop enough for you to go home. Whereas with flooding, for example, is a much more complex phenomenon. But even then, we are improving that and we are getting people to be able to, you know, harvest the crop just before the floods arrive and take precautions to take their property to higher ground if they get the warnings in time. So yes, the effort is being made all across the board to improve our ability to provide warning sufficient time for people to take action, and then people know what actions they need to take when they get the warnings.
Salimul Haq is the director of the International Center for Climate Change and Development in Bangladesh. He's been speaking with us from Dhaka. Salim, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
As you heard, we can learn a lot from Bangladesh in their response to Cyclone Amphan. That's what our weekly Big Fix is supposed to be, a chance to think about climate change solutions. We explore how people around the planet are tackling the climate crisis. Your questions about climate change solutions also help us think about this. Email us at climate@theworld.org and find more of our Big Fix stories at theworld.org/bigfix. We've all been there. You rush to the airport to catch a flight, but it gets delayed, and you're stuck in the terminal for hours. It's terrible. But this guy has you beat.
Imagine being stranded at an airport terminal for 74 days.
74 days. Here's the story. Randy Juan Muller is a soccer player from Ghana. In November, he flew to India for a six-month contract to play there. But the coronavirus hit and India went into lockdown. International flights were canceled, so Muller decided to sleep in the Mumbai airport until flights resumed. But the lockdown kept getting extended.
The lockdown would be extended. It was expected that because of the lockdown, the curve would be flattened a little bit, but that hasn't happened.
Airport security gave Muller food, even fixed his phone once. 74 nights went by before Muller asked for help on Twitter. He tagged Aditya Thackeray, a government minister and president of the Mumbai District Football Association. Within hours, Muller was taken to a hotel where he'll stay until he can fly home to Ghana. In a Twitter video, he thanked the people who helped him out.
Thank you, Aditya Thackeray, Rahul Khanna. Thank you very, very so much. I appreciate what you have done. God bless you. Salute.
Muller said while he toughed it out in the airport, this is what he kept telling himself. Overcome, adapt, never give up. You're listening to The World. When presidential politics and New Year's Eve have something in common.
But you can't let one person ruin the whole entire party.
I'm Marco Werman. We check in with young Latino voters today on the show as they consider the candidates. And men's soccer is back in Spain. Women's soccer is still on pause. And with it, their fight for better pay. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. The nationwide outrage over the death of George Floyd has prompted demand for widespread police reform, but that's not the only demand.
We have got to have reconciliation. This country has not reconciled its differences with us.
That's Democratic Congressman Al Green of Texas speaking at George Floyd's funeral in Houston earlier this week. We wanted to hear what another country's path toward reconciliation looked like. 20 years ago in South Africa, the end of apartheid was marked by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It gave thousands of people a chance to tell the stories of how apartheid played out in their lives. Stan Hakeman is the executive director of the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation in Cape Town. Thank you for being with us. So coming out of apartheid in the early 1990s, there were so many raw emotions after years of oppression. There was a specter of South Africa falling apart, even a race war. How did South Africa even get people to agree that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was the right way to go? How'd you get people, black, white, colored, different social classes, to buy into this?
I think the first thing to say is that there was the Mandela factor, and Mandela proved to be the one person that every South African, irrespective of their background, was able to identify with. The second thing is to understand that the majority of South Africans are not white. And so you can imagine the idea of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission was very appealing to them, because there was so much suffering, and people just saw this as an opportunity to expose what has been happening, but also to close a chapter, a painful chapter of our history. Having said that, the buy-in from the white community was not as enthusiastic. In fact, there were a number of white people who saw this as a witch hunt.
Mm. And so how did you approach that imbalance, and did you eventually get more buy-in from the white population of South Africa?
You know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is an outflow of an act of parliament to promote national reconciliation. White people generally, even though their political parties agree to it, were still skeptical. But as the commission progressed, the fact that it was transparent, it was on television screen on a daily basis, I think that kind of helped make people understand that this is a genuine attempt to try and understand what happened.
And what were the stated objectives of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission once it started?
The process was quite organized. There were three aspects to the commission. The one committee was the committee that investigated gross human rights violations. And the emphasis was on gross human rights violations, because you can imagine every disadvantaged South African, you know, had their human rights violated. Then there was a second committee that looked at the issue of amnesty. Now, that was always going to be a thorny one. And then the third committee had to look at reparations.
My sense is that the whole process was very highly charged and was very emotional for a lot of people, almost like a confessional of sins and victimization. Was there a prosecutorial aspect to any of this?
The only committee that kind of acted like a court was the amnesty committee. And what was really interesting was the fact that people who applied for amnesty did not have to do a public apology. Hmm. Now, imagine that angered a number of people, but the idea was really to get people to come and tell their side of the story. More than 7,000 people applied for amnesty, but only 1,700 odd received amnesty. Now, this is where your question comes in about prosecutions. And this is one area where I think that many South Africans would say we have been failed, because the prosecuting agencies did not follow through on the thousands of people who did not qualify for amnesty.
The world looks at South Africa today and apartheid they see is over. But now there's a profound class difference in South Africa that isn't all about race. When you look at that reality, do you think it's a failure of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
It is a bit unfair to blame the TRC for the problems of our country. And I think the first thing we need to say about the TRC is that it was not going to be the silver bullet that's going to solve the problem and that's going to reconcile the country. It was the beginning of a process. And if you listen to people like Archbishop Desmond Tutu and others, that's exactly how they understood it. Sadly, the rest of the country didn't necessarily understand it in the same way. If we look at the young people today, especially black young people who are still experiencing the struggles of poverty, unemployment, exclusion that their parents went through, they are extremely critical of the TRC. In fact, they call the TRC a whitewash of white atrocities.
I'm curious to know, Mr. Henkemann, as you look at what's going on here in the U.S., what would you say America has to reckon here? And what can Americans learn from South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
You know, if you want to change, you know, it has to start with an acknowledgement. And I think that that's probably where America has to start. Acknowledge the pain, how that pain gets transmitted generationally. And what happened to somebody in the 60s or even earlier affects young people today. And once that acknowledgement happens, then there should be a conversation. I'm not sure whether the U.S. is ready for that conversation, because in South Africa, we have a black majority government, so there is a level of openness. Now, whether they listen to us is another story, but at least there's a willingness to have the conversation. I'm not sure how successful that will be in the States, because you can bring all the changes that you want. But if there's no shift in attitude, in worldview that we hold about other people, in people's place in society, if that doesn't shift, you know, you can make all these cosmetic changes, you will just have a perpetuation of the status quo.
Stan Henkemann is the executive director of the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation in Cape Town. Thank you very much for speaking with us and giving us something to think about.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
In Russia, emergency teams are working nonstop to contain an oil spill in Siberia. The oil has spread about 12 miles so far since it ruptured from an oil tank in the industrial city of Norilsk last month. The spill has now polluted a large lake, and Russian authorities say there's a risk it could spread into the Arctic Ocean. Reporter Charles Maines has been following this from Moscow. Get us up to speed, if you would, Charles. What is the latest on the spill?
Yeah, it's unfortunately more bad news. You know, the spill released about 150,000 barrels of diesel. That's about 20,000 tons of fuel, and it's already contaminated about 135 square miles. And those who've been on the scene say that now appears to be growing. So I reached Sergei Shakhmatov. He's a member of the Green Party out in Krasnoyarsk, where the spill took place. You know, he managed to inspect the spill by helicopter and describes these rivers discolored by the fuel. He says the disaster is on a scale unlike anything the Arctic has ever seen.
So this leaked fuel came from a ruptured oil tank. Any new details about the cause?
Yeah, that's right. And it's brought attention to the company that owns it, a company called Norilsk Nickel. Norilsk Nickel has quite a bad reputation as a polluter, although I should say, you know, the company's tried to improve that image in recent years. In fact, they brought me out a couple years ago to look at how much they've changed. At the time, they just closed down a Soviet-era factory that helped give the town this label as one of the most polluted places on Earth. That's in quotes. You know, and they were very much trying to show off this new Norilsk. But, you know, here we are again, reports of this outdated equipment, that this old fuel tanker had ruptured. And some say it was a disaster waiting to happen.
In what way?
The other key issue here is climate change. Siberia had this freakishly warm spring. It was up in the 90s in May. And that's part of this pattern of warming weather that has real implications for places like Norilsk. It's a city built on what's called permafrost, in other words, built on ground that's frozen year-round. You know, for example, when I was there, I remember looking at buildings that were on stilts, and they had literally cracked in half as the ground underneath them shifted and melted. So the company says that's essentially what happened here with this latest accident. Environmentalists, however, would say it's well documented that the Arctic is warming about twice as fast as the rest of the Earth. That shouldn't come as a surprise.
Right. So climate change is one thing, but more immediately, I understand that delays in the state responding to this disaster are also a problem.
Yeah, that's also true. You know, Russian President Vladimir Putin was visibly angry over what he said were delays. He took the local governor and company officials to task publicly, saying that there were 2 days of no action before federal authorities were involved. And this being Russia, the search for guilty parties is on. We've got a criminal investigation. The mayor of Norilsk is charged with negligence. We've had top managers at the plant where the fuel tank collapsed arrested yesterday. You know, and there's this sense that this delay kind of reflects a built-in flaw in the Russian system when it comes to bad news, which is that nobody wants to give it.
Мы не учимся на своих ошибках. У нас уже было много таких катастроф.
So this is Andrei Zolotko from the environmental group Bologna. He says that, you know, Russia never learns from these mistakes, that the leadership on the local level are scared to pass information up the chain, and they tend to think more about their careers and saving their skins than actually trying to, you know, take action for the crisis of the moment.
So given all these miscues and mistakes, are there calls for reform?
Well, you know, of course, the short term, it's about the cleanup, and we'll see where the criminal charges lead. But, you know, some say this is a wake-up call. There's calls for more oversight, maybe more regulation, but it's been more words than deeds so far. I think the bigger problem here is the Kremlin sees Russia's economic future in oil and gas and Arctic exploration. And, you know, it's been a lot of years of talking about diversifying the economy, but it's hard to see them cutting off the tap.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow speaking with us about the Norilsk oil spill up in Siberia. Charles, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Pretty steadily, he's been chopping away at it. Today, another attempt by the Trump administration to dramatically reshape the asylum system in the United States. The White House proposal would make it more difficult for applicants to gain asylum here and would change who would actually get asylum hearings in the first place. Luis Cortez Romero is an immigration lawyer in Seattle. How sweeping of a change is this, Luis, to our existing asylum system? And what was your reaction to the proposal?
This is a humongous structural change to the already very limited rights that asylum seekers had. It does a lot to turn away recent arrival asylum applicants, but it also does a lot to erode the rights for people who are already in the United States who may want to seek asylum in the future.
So what are the details? How exactly would these proposed changes make it more difficult for migrants to claim asylum in the U.S.?
It provides a lot of barriers and hurdles to even apply, and it makes it significantly more easier and streamlined in order to deny their application. And let me give you some examples to be concrete. One of the things that the proposal does is that it makes it so that if anybody has spent more than 14 days in any other country before coming to the United States, that they would be banned then from applying for asylum here. And so that applies to a lot of the Central American migrants or people come from South America who oftentimes it takes them a month to get here.
Right. And I was going to say, if you're on foot, 14 days, that's pretty much that, right?
Yes, that's that. So it becomes a non-starter for a lot of the migrants. More so, for the recent arrivals, there's an initial process called the credible fear process, where an officer will just determine a kind of a first glance whether you have a credible fear of being persecuted in your country. And if so, then you can go ahead and apply for asylum with an immigration judge and the immigration court. The standard to be able to pass a credible fear interview is now significantly higher. And then even if you make it, the immigration judge now has the authority to completely just deny your application without even a hearing if the immigration judge sees that he's not likely or she's not likely to grant the application.
We also need to discuss DACA here, Luis, a Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, a program that allows undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as minors to remain to study or work. If the Supreme Court rules against DACA, we're still waiting for some decision, could these new changes impact DACA recipients who try to seek asylum in the U.S.?
100%. So if the Supreme Court strikes down DACA, what the heads of the Department of Homeland Security have made clear is that they do plan to place DACA recipients into removal proceedings, the process that it takes for someone to be ultimately deported, and that typically goes with a hearing before an immigration judge. The one lifeline that DACA recipients could have had to try to save themselves in removal proceedings is now being not just structurally changed, but gutted from its all the due process rights. And so ultimately, the consequence will be that once DACA recipients are placed in removal proceedings, the ability to fight your case to stay here now is significantly diminished from an already limited basis.
You yourself are a DACA recipient, Luis. You were also part of the legal team that argued to the Supreme Court for DACA's continuation. How are you seeing this raft of restrictions once you look at the sum total?
Certainly, it's going to be met with a lot of legal challenges because the fundamental notion that the United States has is the ability to be heard and the ability to have a fair proceeding. So we think there's going to be a lot of legal challenges, you know, challenging the stripping away of the basic due process rights that asylum seekers may have, which ultimately may include DACA recipients in the future.
Immigration attorney Luis Cortez Romero speaking with us from Seattle. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you're a regular listener, you know that all this year we're following the stories of young Latino voters across the United States. Our coverage is centered on a simple reality. Every 30 seconds, a young Latino turns 18 and is eligible to vote. That's why we call our series Every 30 Seconds. We are only 5 months away from Election Day on November 3rd, so we're checking in on what we've been hearing from these voters so far with the world's Daisy Contreras, the project's senior editor. Hey, Daisy.
Hey, Marco.
So you've been working with reporters at public radio stations across the country. They're following the lives of young Latino voters. But this is definitely not the spring of typical presidential primaries that we were expecting. What are some of the takeaways so far?
It's been quite an interesting several months of coverage. We've been learning about how complex the Latino vote is. These are young voters who are no longer immigrants. Maybe their parents or grandparents were, though. But these young people have grown up here in the United States, and they care about things like climate change, healthcare, affording college, and the economy. We've heard from voters like Michelle Aguilar Ramirez in Seattle. Her mom is an immigrant from Guatemala and works at a warehouse. She's worked through the pandemic and still struggles to get by. Mm. For this family, the economic challenges were there before COVID.
It's hard because my mom is like a single mom and she can barely get ends meet and stuff, even though like she works and works and works and she does overtime and she still can't figure it out.
For voters like Michelle, issues like immigration and healthcare costs continue to be at the top of her list.
You mentioned, Daisy, a few of the issues grabbing these new voters' attention. There's climate change, the economy, college affordability. These are, or were anyway, priorities for some young Latino voters. But then the pandemic hit. How has that changed how they're thinking about the election now?
Well, their issues have remained the same. But yes, the pandemic hit. And for some of these voters, that has been a deciding factor, or at least it is influencing how they might vote in November. Like Jacob Cuenca, who lives just south of Miami. He considers himself to be a Republican.
All right. Look, like Trump, like he says like some nonsense and like, and obviously, I really don't agree with a lot of things he does, like, you know, like building the wall or like and how he thinks like climate change is fake. But you can't like let like one person ruin the whole entire party.
Now, Jacob isn't so sure he'll actually vote for the Republican candidate and says he doesn't think Republicans have done enough during the pandemic. Jacob is still weighing his options.
So, Daisy, as you follow the political viewpoints of these young voters almost in real time, it sounds like you have seen a lot of change.
These young voters are definitely reacting to the changes we've witnessed these last few months. Through these stories, I think that we're getting a better understanding on what makes the 2020 election different from other years.
Daisy, thank you very much for this update.
Thank you so much, Marco.
That's the world's Daisy Contreras. To learn more about the young voters we're following this year, go to theworld.org/every30seconds and follow the series. Spanish men's soccer is back today after a three-month pause due to the coronavirus. La Liga is returning to action just with no crowds and strict safety protocols. But for the Spanish women, no such luck. Their season has been completely canceled. Some of the players say this is yet another example of unequal treatment. And it's especially frustrating as Spanish women players had begun to make strides toward greater equity. Lucia Benavides has our story.
Last year, women's soccer in Spain was on a high.
Spain are the underdogs. Can they cause a huge upset?
The Spanish women came close at the World Cup in France.
Patri Haro, across goal! Great chance for Spain. And a real scare for the United States.
But the Spanish women couldn't quite pull it off.
Spain worked so, so hard. But it is the defending champions who march on.
The U.S. team, the eventual champs last year, beat Spain by one goal. Some months later, the professional women's players signed the only existing collective bargaining agreement for any women's sport in Spain. Just 1 week after the contract was signed in February, I went to watch the Madrid women's club on a cold and windy day. They riled each other up to go outside and run. Forward Ana Lucia Martinez played on first division teams for 5 years and says the first club she played for didn't even give her a contract. Her salary was 200 euros a month, about $230. And for a while, she considered quitting the game altogether. Now, she's one of the better paid players in her team and makes enough money to pay her bills and concentrate on soccer full time. Still, many of her teammates rely on side jobs to get by.
Tal vez no como los chicos que se retiran y ya son millones los que cobran, pero
Martina says, unlike her male counterparts who make millions, enough to never work again after they retire, female players need to start building their backup plan, their next career, while they're still playing. But this February felt like a deeper shift began to take place. Spain's 16 first division teams signed their historic agreement, guaranteeing female players a minimum wage, protocols for sexual abuse cases, and paid maternity leave. It took a year of negotiations and a week-long strike to achieve this. One of the lawyers working on the case was María José López.
It was necessary to have this agreement for the sake of equality.
López represented the main soccer union. She says the agreement is exactly the same as the one signed by the men decades ago, except for one thing, their salaries. In Spain, the base salary for men's soccer is $170,000 a year. The women's is $18,000. Men's games draw bigger crowds and more advertising dollars on Spanish television. This means more revenue, which then translates into high salaries. López gets this. Still, she says the wage gap needs to shrink.
El debate que siempre no lo echan a la cara, a veces yo hablo como jurista, ¿vale? No, no, aquí es que
the argument we always hear is these girls don't bring in money, so they can't make demands. No, these are working women who deserve workers' rights.
She also says if advertisers would invest more in the women's game, there would be more interest, leading to more ticket sales, television programming, and eventually higher salaries. But all of this is on hold because of the pandemic. Tamara Ramos directs another soccer union that signed the collective bargaining agreement this February.
Se entiende que los clubes no tienen la capacidad suficiente ni el presupuesto suficiente.
Ramos says she believes the coronavirus outbreak will disproportionately affect the female leagues, which were already struggling with funding.
¿Por qué vuelve la primera y la segunda y el femenino no?
Why do the men's leagues come back after lockdown, but not the women's, she asks. It's all part of the same problem, lack of resources. In this case, coronavirus test kits and equipment to implement necessary safety measures.
Entonces, era una sensación un poco agridulce, la verdad.
Ramos says signing the collective bargaining agreement was a bittersweet moment. It was a big step forward, but she worries people will get complacent and stop pushing for more change that still needs to be done. For The World, Lucia Benavides, Madrid.
And that's where we sign off today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. I'll be right back here tomorrow. Hope you are too.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.